sacred script, history of the sacred script. As we begin to examine one aspect of the sacred script, which is in Torah script, and it is also in the Tefillin or in the Mezuzah, and that is the Tag. The Tag. Tag is like a tag, basically. It's maybe where the English word comes from. In Hebrew, it's Tag. And it is also alternatively referred to as a Keter. Keter, if you know Hebrew, is in a way much more revealing. It's a crown, a crown. And in fact, in the sacred script, when you are a sofer and you are writing one of those documents, you have to make sure that certain letters have crowns on them. They have crowns. Now, for example, if you'll take a look at the mezuzah scroll that we have here, which is on the top of the Xerox copies, let's just see. Look at Shema Yisrael. Okay? Look at the shin. On the left side of the shin, of the Shema. Okay, you may have to take off your glasses to see this. I do. The left side of it, you can see it even better in the shin of Yisrael. The shin of Yisrael. See the left side? At the top, it has a crown. It really looks like a crown. It looks like a crown. But before you get to that, look at the Ayin of Shema. The Ayin of Shema. Israel. Hashem. Now, you can look at the Yud Hey Vav Hey. Look at the Hey. Hey is a little bit odd.
It's like a mini crown.
It's like a mini crown, exactly. There's something on the left side of the top of the hay, there seems to be, number one, a line that goes up, and then an additional line, okay? So you rightly called that like a mini crown. Look at Eloheinu. Eloheinu. You've got a nun, and
thank you,
Eloheinu. Look at the... No, the Lamed... The Lamed is just you have to be careful because some of the letters actually have sort of a flourish on them, but not necessarily a crown. And the crown actually has three parts to it.
Crown on the Nun.
You have a crown on the Nun, okay? Now look at another letter that's odd here, Echad. Look at the Chad. Because you have, look at the Chet. In the Echad, you have the top of the Chet, which is normally a straight line, has a, I don't know what you want to call that, an inverted V in it. Okay? Echad. V'avta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha. Nafshecha, we again have a Nun and a Shin. Those are not really crowns. Aela, Asher, the Shin again. Anochi, Anun, Mitzavecha, the Tzadi. We haven't had a Tzadi yet. Look at the Tzadi. The Tzadi has a crown. Tzadi has a. Al Levavecha, again the Ayin. Vishin Nan Dam. Two Nuns. Each of the Nuns has a crown. Okay? And the Shin. And the Shin has one too. Levanecha, the Nun of the Vanecha. V'divarta bam b'shivtecha has a crown, the Shin. V'techo v'lachcha v'derech. U'v'shofpecha, the Shin again. And then ukshartam, Shin. Letotafot. We haven't had a Tet yet. So here the Tet of Letotafot, both Tets have crowns on the left side. Okay? Bain, so we saw that the regular Nun has it, and also the Nun Sofit has it. The final Nun has a crown. Einecha, you have an Ayin and a Nun. Uchtatam Al, And look at mezuzot. You have two zions. Each zion has a crown. Each zion has a crown. Beitecha uvisha'arecha. So you see that there are these stylistic issues which you might just think of as aesthetic. So these are aesthetic issues, but in fact they are more than aesthetic issues. Okay? Any questions so far just about what we've shown?
What determines what letters were getting the crowns?
Ah, that's a good question. That's a good question. What determines that you have a crown? All right, that's the first question. Second question would be what letters get the crown and what determines that? Okay? Perfectly good question, which I won't answer yet. Okay?
All the mezuzot are uniformly written in this.
Correct. Correct. Not only mezuzot, but tefillin and sefer Torah. Every sefer Torah in the whole world is written with these crowns on only those letters. On only those letters. And in fact, those letters make up the Hebrew words shatnez gatz. Shatnez gatz. Shatnez, shin, ayin, tet, nun, zayin. Like the word shatnez that you have in the Bible, which is mixed clothing of mixed wool and linen. That's shatnez. And then gatz is gimel tzadi. So shin, ayin, tet, nun, zayin, gimel tzadi. Those are the letters that get crowns. They have tagim or ketarim.
Did you say
tav? Excuse me? Not tav.
Tet.
Tet, yes. Shatnez. Shin, tet, nun, zayin. Okay. Shin, ayin, tet, nun, zayin. Because the ayin also gets it. Okay? Now let's go into our text, and we are going to now read an Agadah. An Agadah is a piece of rabbinic literature which is not halakha, it's not law. It will frequently contain reference to law, but this is one of the great Agadot of the Talmud that you're about to read. And just keep in mind just that you are reading a piece of literature, and part of this is just the literary form of what we're about to read. The literature itself, I'm going to go through it a little bit slowly just because the pieces of it are, as literature, quite something that you'll see. And then there are hidden in this the halakhic issues that we've just raised. The question of the tagim and why they are where they are. Okay? Now, we are on page 29B1. If you are following in the actual Talmud text itself, which is where I'm going to be reading from, I'm doing this because of a few reasons. First of all, the actual Talmud text, I may translate it differently than the Arshkol has translated it. Arshkol, you know, tends to be rather literalistic and not particularly philosophical. And when you have an Agadah that is so rich in philosophical depths, I think that it will certainly, is sometimes oversimplified. That's one reason. Secondly, the actual Talmud page itself has some fascinating commentary, which I think you should be looking at. Look at that. Now we're on, the page is Kaftet, Amud Bet, 29B. Okay, you're on 29A. So go to 29B. 29B is Kaftet with two dots next to it. Two dots indicate the B page. Now what I want you to see there is on the right side of the page, occasionally in the commentators, either in Rashi or here it is in the Tosafot, you will see they illustrate the point. They illustrate the point. And here you see illustrations because it's not completely clear to the commentators what the crowns consist of, number one. But you see certain efforts at explaining them. And we'll look at that a little more closely a little bit later. But I did want you to just get a sense of the visual nature of the commentary here, because you don't usually see that in either Rashi or the Tosafot. It's usually verbose, and it's language. But here, it's illustrative. Okay? Right, now I'm starting in the Talmud text. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down from the top of the text. If you're reading in the English, it's 29b1 on the right side of the page, the third line. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav. Now, just to pinpoint what the dates are here, what we're talking about. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, because they're named Rav, that indicates that they're Babylonian Amoraim. A Babylonian Amora is a teacher who taught in Babylonia after the close of the Mishnah. After the close of the Mishnah, okay? So this is post-200. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, finishes the Mishnah, publishes it in 200. And so this is from a period immediately after that. And this is a formulation which we've already seen, interestingly enough, a few times already. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda lives in the 3rd century, so this is in the century after the close of the Mishnah. After the close of Mishnah, lives in Babylonia, and his dates are 220 to 299. Okay? So he was born after the time of the Mishnah. Rav dies in 247. So that means that he was alive and well and a student during the days of Rabbi Judah the Prince. So he was a contemporary of Rabbi Judah the Prince. Rav is a very key figure because he goes to Babylonia from the land of Israel. He studies first in the land of Israel. He goes to Babylonia, and there he founds one of the two great yeshivot, the yeshiva of Sura. There are two major yeshivot founded in the 3rd century. One is Sura and one is Pumbedita. Rav founds Sura. Okay? And the key reason why he is so significant is that Rav is a crossover figure. He is one of these people who is at the end of one era and the beginning of another era. Studies in the atmosphere, the area of Rabbi Judah the Prince while he's yet alive, and carries that then to Babylonia. You'll see that this Agadah that we are going to read, even though it is in the name of two Amoraim, is in Hebrew. Normally, such Agadah would be in Aramaic. Okay? This one is in Hebrew. So it shows that there's a certain rootedness of this Agadah in the land of Israel, or maybe even that it predates the ones who are telling us the Agadah. Okay, perhaps we're reading an Agadah that really goes back further, maybe into the beginning of the 2nd century, partly because of the Hebrew, and you'll see that the Hebrew here is quite extraordinary. It's just classic rabbinic Hebrew. Okay, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. B'sha'a sha'ala Moshe l'marom. When Moses went up on high. Now, what is not said there, of course, is you know why he went up on high. He went up to get the Torah. Right? So when Moses went up on high to get the Torah, Mitzao l'hakadosh baruch hu shiyoshev v'kosher kitarim la'otyot. He saw that the Holy One, blessed be He, was attaching crowns to the letters of the Torah. Right? What an image. Just it's an incredible image. Right? Amar lefanav. He said, Moses says to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, mi niakev al yadcha, who could disqualify this Torah that you've written? In other words, if you didn't write crowns on the Torah, it would still be a kosher Torah. Because whatever Torah you're writing is the definition of a kosher Torah. So why in the world are you going out of your way to write these crowns on the Sefer Torah? This is Moses questioning the wisdom of God. Okay. So here you'll see how God answers him. Min me'akev, and there you have the same language that we've been using. Who would disqualify this Torah? Okay, same thing. You know, if you're missing a letter, it's me'akev. That's what we have had so far in the text. It has the force of disqualification. Amar lo, God says to him, Adam echad yesh atid lehiyot besof kama dorot. There is one man who will come to be in the future, at the end of many generations, the Akiva ben Yosef Shamo, and his name is Akiva, the son of Joseph, Sha'atid lidrosh al kol kotz v'kotz, who in the future will interpret every single jot and tittle, every little thing in the Torah, he will interpret. Tilin, tilin shel halachot, mountains and mountains of laws. All right? So that's God's answer to Moses. Amar lefanav, Moses says back to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, har ehu li, show me him. Amar lo, God says to Moses, chazor liachorcha, turn around. Turn around. Halach, he goes into a time machine, as it were. Moses goes into a time machine. Halach v'yashav b'sof shmona shurot. He goes and sits in the yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva. And of course, in the yeshivas, in those days, there were rows. In the front row were the best students. In the back row, the eighth row, were the worst students. Where is Moshe sitting? Sitting in the back row of the yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva. Right? Wonderful image. V'lo haya yodea ma hen omrim. And he had no idea what they were talking about. Moses, who gets the Torah from God, goes down to hear Rabbi Akiva interpret it. He has no idea what Rabbi Akiva is talking about. No idea what he's talking about. Imagine that. Tashash kocho. He gets weak. He's just so upset that he can't understand the Torah. Kevan shehigia l'davar echat. When they got to one particular matter, Amru lo talmidav. His students said to him, the students of Rabbi Akiva say to him, Rabbi, minayin lecha. Rabbi, how do you know the answer to this? Where is your theory coming from? Amar lehem, he says to them, halacha lemoshe mi Sinai. This is the law to Moses from Mount Sinai. All right? Nityash fadato. Moses, calm down. So Moses, who had been so upset, so he suddenly hears that Rabbi Akiva quotes him, that he's the source of the law. He doesn't know what they're talking about, but it's good. He feels happy to see this. Okay? Chazar uva lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbi Akiva goes back to God. Moses goes back to God. And he says to the Holy One, blessed be He, Ribono shel olam, Yesh lecha adam kazeh, v'ata noten Torah al yadi. You have a man like this, and you're giving me the one to be the one to give the Torah? Should be to him. He's the one who should receive the Torah, not me. Right? Who am I next to this Rabbi Akiva? Amar lo, God says to him, shtok. Kach ala b'machashava lefanai. Be silent. So it has come into my mind. In other words, this is my decision. This is a divine decision. You're a human being. You wonder why Rabbi Akiva isn't the one. You can't ask questions like that. All right? I'm God, you're not. And therefore, shtok, be quiet. Be quiet. Kach Allah v'machshava lefanav. Amma lefanav. Moses now then says to God, Ribono shalom, Lord of the world, Heretani Torato, you have shown me his Torah. Harini Scharo, show me his reward. Amar lo, God says to him, Chazor la'achorcha, turn around. Chazani acharav, he turned around. Ra'a sheshoklin basar bisaro b'mekolin. He saw that they were weighing out the flesh of Rabbi Akiva in the marketplace. Rabbi Akiva was a martyr, and the Romans took combs and cut his body up. And so Moses sees that this is the reward for this giant, the one who should really receive the Torah. This is where he ends up. Amar lefanav, Moses says to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, zo Torah v'zo schara. What a phrase. Zo Torah v'zo schara. This is the Torah and this is its reward. Amar lo, he said, God says to him, shtok, kach ala b'machashava lefanai. Be silent. Such is my decree. That's the end of the Agada. Incredible piece of literature. Just an incredible thing. It's just on many different levels here. The sense of time, the juxtaposition of vastly separate, anachronistic times, done with such ease and with such humor. Such humor. It's this classic rabbinic Hebrew where everything is extremely simple and it's repetitive. The language is a repetitive language. Shtok, kach, alaba, machashava, lefanai. Chazor le'achorcha. It repeats the same thing. Classic rabbinic Haggadah has that form. Read Shmuel Yosef Agnon. Same form. Agnon copies this form in his great writings. It's basically an updating of this classic form of Agada. Yes. Alaba machshava. Alaba machshava lefanai.
Is that a common?
It's a classic way of
describing God's
correct.
Decision.
Correct.
Sorry.
It's. Let me just
God
see.
God thinking is just like, whoa.
It comes from the book of Isaiah. And it is the Haftorah reading on a fast day. Haftorah reading from Isaiah on a fast day. Where Isaiah is dealing with the destruction of the Jews, and God says, Lo machshavotai machshavotecha. Those are Isaiah's words. Lo machshavotai machshavotecha. By the time you get to Rabbinic Hebrew, the form changes slightly. Masha ole b'machshavti. Okay? Kach ala b'machshava lefanai. That's the Rabbinic way of saying it. Any other question so far? Okay? Of course, the subject here is the subject of Tagim, of the Keter, the Ketarim, that we were just looking at. the Ketarim have their source here in the revelation itself. In the revelation itself. So when you ask, how do we know that this is where it, that we're supposed to do this? This is how we know, because that's how God gave the Torah to Moses. In other words, this was divinely inspired. Divinely inspired. And that's in a way reinforced in the story when Rabbi Akiva himself, who was known for such interpretation of crowns and of all the very tiny things about the letters, when he says to his students that the answer to the question is Halacha LaMoshe MiSinai. It is the law from Moses on Mount Sinai. So that is the status of this, in fact. You're dealing with practice, with halacha, that is halacha LaMoshe MiSinai. It is the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, and it was shown to him. Here you have this notion also of the revelation being visual at something which is very hard for us to understand and not usual in Jewish thought. Usually, we consider the revelation to be entirely an oral experience. And in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus, when you read about the sound and light and the revelation of the Ten Commandments, we think of it entirely as an oral experience. But it isn't entirely an oral experience, either in the Bible. And we tend to not look at the things that the Bible says, certainly not in the rabbinic literature. In the Bible, in several different places, there is an underlining of the visual nature of the revelation. First of all, there in the 20th chapter, in the end of the 19th chapter of Exodus, you would look and see the kolot and the brakim. The Jewish people would look and see the thunder and the lightning. Well, you can see lightning, but you can't see thunder. Here is one instance where you have a transformation of an image. You have two images that don't work together. And so normally we would just say, well, you know, it's a little exaggeration. That's what it is. I don't think it's an exaggeration at all. I think it's very basic to one notion of the revelation itself is that it was partially visual. Partially visual. Okay? You have that made most explicit. Let's see, it's in, not in this coming, with this week's Parsha's Yitro. So there you'll see what I'm talking about right now. So there you'll see. In another few weeks, we will be reading about the construction of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And there, later on in that discussion, God says to Moses, you shall make it exactly kafisha horeti lacha, or horeti, not hereti, but horeti. Horeti in the Hebrew is a passive. You shall make it exactly as I showed you. As I showed you. So there is a sense that Moses was shown visually. There's a vision that was there. So I'm underlining this, I'm emphasizing it to emphasize two sides of revelation. One of which we're used to, which is the oral side of revelation. And with the oral side of revelation comes, oh, I don't know, reason, thinking about the revelation, all that comes orally. You know, visual experience is somewhat different from oral experience. And yet there is room for that here too. And interestingly enough, it seems to be in connection with Rabbi Akiva. With Rabbi Akiva. Okay? Rabbi Akiva is the one who interpreted these things, was filled with such interpretations, and it's Rabbi Akiva who is the main figure here. Now, of course, in the latter part of the Agadah, is the tragic side of it. Is the tragic side, which is just so extraordinary. You know, if you think this is a simple religion, you know, that the good people get what they deserve, the bad people get what they deserve, and so on. You know, if you haven't read the book of Job, just read a story like this. You know, the best people end up being the ones who suffer. And it's completely incomprehensible. Totally incomprehensible. This is precisely the same answer that is given to Job. When he asks the question again and again, his friends say to him, well, the good people get rewarded, the bad people, they suffer. And if you're suffering, you just must have forgotten what your sins are. Those are Job's friends. Friends like that, with friends like that, you don't need enemies, correct? So then God appears to him out of the whirlwind. And God says to him, where were you when I created the foundations of the earth? Namely, what do you know, stupid fool? You know, you think that you understand how this world works? You don't have a clue to how this world really works. You know, maybe you'll learn a little bit here and there. I've given you a Torah. Be dependent upon that. But you don't understand anything. That's what Job learns. Interestingly enough, that's what Rabbi Akiva, what Moses learns, the same thing, through the figure of Rabbi Akiva. I thought I would read to you the fuller reference here. The story is fleshed out. The story of the martyrdom of Rabbi Akiva appears in the Babylonian Talmud in the Tractate of Brachot. It's Brachot Daf Samach Aleph Amud Bet. It's toward the end of the Tractate of Brachot, 61b, Samach Aleph Amud Bet. Tanu Rabbanan, it's a Baraita. Right, again, is something from the period of the Mishnah, which is left out of the Mishnah. Pamachat gazra malchut arisha'a. One time, the evil empire made an edict, shelo yasku Yisrael b'Torah. The Jews are not allowed to study the Torah. Papus ben Yehuda. Now, the name Papus ben Yehuda is a very interesting name because he's ben Yehuda. So it seems like he's a Jew. His name is Papus. So Papus is, it's a Latin name. So he must have been a very assimilated Jew. And again, the Agadah is very careful, Agadot are very carefully written. There was nothing happened that written here by happenstance. So in other words, we are hearing an assimilated Jew who is essentially a Roman, a Jewish Roman, or a Roman, Romanish Jew. Papus ben Yehuda, mitzaol Rabbi Akiva. He comes and he finds Rabbi Akiva, shayam makhil ke'elot barabim ba'osek v'torah. Rabbi Akiva was gathering Jews together into groups and was teaching Torah. They were studying Torah. Osek Torah is rabbinic Hebrew for studying Torah. Amar lei, Papus says to Akiva, Akiva, I atam mitjare mitnei malchut, aren't you afraid of the empire, of the government? The government had decreed that it's forbidden, and the Romans are not easy people to deal with. Amar lo, Akiva says to him, imsholach hamashal. Let me tell you a story. Lema hadavar domeh. What is this like? L'shu'al shahaya me'alech al gabei anahar. Like a fox who is walking on the side of a river. V'ra'a dagim shahayu mitkabsim mimakom lemakom. And he saw fish who gathered together in different places. Amar lehem, he says to the fish, now you know what a fox is interested in. Amar lehem, he says, mipnei ma'atem borchim, why are you running away? Amru lo, they said to him, the fish say to him, mipnei rishatot shemivim alenu b'nei adam, I'm afraid of the nets. We're afraid of the nets that people are coming to catch us with. Amar lahem, the fox says to them, Ritzonchem shetalu liyabasha. Why don't you come out of the water? V'nadur ani v'atem k'shem shedaru avotai im avotechem. And you and I will live together as friends the way our ancestors always did. This is the sly fox to the fish. Amru lo, they said to him, Ata hu sha'omrim alecha pikeach shebachayot. You're the one that they say is the smartest of all the animals? Lo pikeach ata, you're not so smart. Ela tipesh ata, you are dumb, you're stupid. Ma bimakom chiyutenu anu mityarim. If in the place where we in fact can live, we are afraid. Bimakom mitatenu ala hakama vachama. In the place where is certain death, how much more so should we be afraid? Afanachnu. Now this is now Rabbi Akiva speaking to Pappas. So it is for us. Achshav sha'anu yoshvim ba'oskim ba'torah. Now that we are sitting and studying the Torah, shekatuv ba, about who, in which is written, ki hu chayecha ve'orech yamecha. It is your life and the length of your days. Kach, so, im anu hochim mivatlim mimena. If we were to not study it, alachat kama v'chama, how much more so would we be afraid? Would we be subject to the Romans? Amru. It was then said, lo ayu yamim muatim. Not even a few days passed. Ad shetafsuhu l'Rabbi Akiva. Until they caught Rabbi Akiva, Chavshuhu beveta asurim, and they put him in prison. The tafsula Papus ben Yehuda, and they also caught Papus ben Yehuda. The chavshuhu, it's low, and they put him in jail with Rabbi Akiva. Amar lo, Rabbi Akiva says to him, Papus, mi chalachan, what are you doing here? Amar le, Papus says to him, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva, you are the one who is happy. Shnitpasta al divrei Torah, you are caught studying Torah. Oy lo lepapas, woe to papas shnitpas al dvarim debetelim, who is caught for nothing. Who is caught for no good reason. Pesha'a shehotziu Rabbi Akiva lahariga. When they took Rabbi Akiva out to be put to death, Zman Kriyat Shema Haya. It was the time for the reading of the Shema. Vayu sorkin et bisaro bimasrekot shel barzel. They combed his flesh with razors. Vaya mekabel alav ol malchut shamayim. And he accepted upon himself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. That's to say, he recited the Shema. He recited the Shema. Amru lo talmidav. His students said to him, Rabbeinu Akan, a rabbi, to hear even you are reciting the Shema in this place? Amar lahem, he said to them, Kol yamai hayiti mitzta'er al pasuk ze b'chol nafshecha. My whole life I was troubled by the fact of this verse which says, Bechol nafshecha, with all of your soul. Afilu noter let nafshecha, even if they were to take your soul. Amarti, I said to myself, Matai yavol yadi de'aka yemenu? When will it be possible for me to observe Bechol nafshecha, with all of your soul? Yachshav shebali adi, and now in fact that it has come into my possession, I have this opportunity. lo akayimena? Shall I not observe it? Haya marich b'achad. He lengthens his recitation of the word echad. Ad shiyatzta nishmato b'achad. Until his soul departed with the word one. Yatzta bat kol v'yamra. A voice came from heaven. It said, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva. Happy are you, Rabbi Akiva. Shiyatz'ah nishmatcha b'achad. Your soul departed with one. The word one, saying God is one. That is, by the way, why we recite Echad to this day. When you recite the word Echad, you say, there are four laws of the recitation. One is that you have to pronounce it. You can't mumble it. Okay? Two, that you have to pronounce the ayin of Shema and the dalet of Echad. Because the ayin and the dalet put together are the word Ed. You're bearing witness to the existence of God and the presence of God in the world by saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And therefore you pronounce the dalet. So you will hear people who are careful about it, making careful that they pronounce the dalets. And then in the Echad, you don't say Echad, you say Echad. That's the way you pronounce the Echad. In order to repeat the way that Rabbi Akiva said it when he gave his life and his soul went out with the recitation of Echad. Okay? That's the backstory to what you have in Menachot. Okay? The story in Menachot presupposes that you already know that story and makes use of it and really raises the theological issue of how could it be that such would be the reward for the great master of Torah, which is a very potent and continually perplexing theological issue that will always, forever and ever be raised. And the answer is always the same. Kach halava machshava lefanai. There is no other answer to that question. Okay? Question?
I'm confused about the time issue because it seems like God is doing something and Moses is asking him, Why are you waiting? Why aren't you giving it already, like it should have been given? And then God refers him to the future, but then when he goes to the future Akiva refers him back to the past. And then he says, well, why didn't you just give it to the person in the future? I don't even want it. And then God says, you don't understand my ways. So I'm confused about the jumping of time.
You should be.
Okay.
Because it's all confused. And it's meant to be confused.
But the future and the past are connected
the
and the
they're,
same?
They're the same, correct. In the revelation, there is no future and there is no past. Okay? Whether there's a present which unites the future and the past, if there is such a thing as present. But the presence is really the result of being in that past and in that future. So it is totally confused time, and it is meant to be, because that's essential to the revelation. Correct.
Why are the adornments on those specific letters as they're shown?
Okay. Kach Allah b'machashava l'fanai. Such was his decree. That's what it was. And of course, then, once it is a certain way, comes Rabbi Akiva, and that Rabbi Akiva lives 137, 135 is Rabbi Akiva's date. So it's, and Moses is roughly 1200 BCE. So you're talking 1350 years later, roughly. Almost 1350 years later. That's a fruitful place for interpretation. If you see, for example, the kind of interpretation that goes on of the Torah to our day, there's no end to it. There simply is no end to it. But there is every possibility, of course, depending upon what you're willing to do. When you hear, as I made it the practice, and Rabbi Bolton continues this practice, the study of commentaries on the weekly reading of the Torah, it's always extraordinary to me that there's no end to it. And there is also, it's always, every once in a while we've had Christians who are present and hear what we do with Torah study, and they just can't understand what's going on. The common reaction is, what are you doing? If you're a religion, there must be a right answer, because of the very nature of religion is to have a right answer. The essence of this religion, there may be a right practice. That's different from the right answer. There may be a mandatory practice, because that's the nature of the religion. But the right answer, the right interpretation of the Torah is completely beyond us. Or, it's not beyond us, it's just this one says, and that one says, and this one says, and that one says. Some of them are more convincing than others. I'll go a little bit further with that. Let's go a little bit further. The truth is, let me hand this out. Yes.
But isn't this saying this is something you can't ask about? And we ask about everything. There's something you can't ask a question about. And this is basically saying, but just don't ask about. Right, but that's rare. If we analyze everything. This is
You're right. God says these very harsh words, stuck. I mean, be quiet. I guess this is, at a certain point, God loses patience. And you do see that. This is surprising, but it's not what we would usually expect.
I still don't understand the purpose of the Agada, other than why couldn't they just say there is no answer, this is problem?
Oh, no, they have to say it this way.
But because there are various points throughout the Talmud where we don't know an answer. I mean, they'll say keku, or they'll come to, but I mean, the point is that they come to similar conclusion, and they.
All right, well, maybe I'll answer that in what I'm about to say. Maybe that it's essentially where I'm going now. I think that for those of you who were in this class last year, you'll remember that we met Rabbi Akiva once before. And we met Rabbi Akiva as a central figure last year when we were studying in Masechet Chagigah the chapter about Maaseh Merkava, the theory of the chariot. And we were reading about mysticism. And I want to recall for you, as well as for those of you who are not here, the passage in the Talmud. This is in Masechet Chagigah 14b. Yud Dalet Amud Bet, 14b. It goes like this. Arba'a nichnesu lepardes. Four entered Pardes. And Pardes, I interpreted as meaning mystical experience. Paradise. It's the source of the English word paradise. And really what it is referring to is mystical experience. Mystical experience. So there were four who entered into such profound mystical experience. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, the Rabbi Akiva. Right? Four people. We don't really know whether this Agadah is telling us that they were sitting around together and they were, you know, getting high, as it were, having an experience together, or whether the Agadah simply conflates it. That's my guess, actually, that though these people were more or less contemporaries, I don't think there's any reason to really see this as reflecting an event that took place. But this is the Agadah's way of saying that there were four rabbis who were mystically inclined. Again, now, you're dealing with an Agadah, a Tanur Rabbanan, of the rabbinic period. All right, so this is from, this is before the completion of the Mishnah. It's within the first two centuries of this. Rabbi Akiva dies in 135. Right? He's killed by the Romans in 135. So my guess is that this is written between 135 and 200, a relatively short period of time, 65-year period of time, and a time before which certainly there was a great deal of mystical interest. There always has been. There always is interest in mysticism. There were certain forms of mysticism. Among them, the form referred to here as Merkava mysticism, the mysticism of the chariot, which is a mysticism that is based on the language of the prophet Ezekiel. Right? Ezekiel, in the first chapter of Ezekiel, first beyond and beyond that, talks in the language of a chariot and the wheels, the spinning of the wheels. These are mystical visions. These are psychedelic visions. And, as I say, in all likelihood, has always been such interest, but it has different forms at different times. It certainly has even in our own time, it very much is an interest of people. Not of everybody, by any means. But we see here that there were four individuals, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher. Now, Acher, those of you who were here last year will remember, is a euphemism for Elisha ben Abuya. Elisha ben Abuya is called Acher, the other one. His name is not mentioned, and the Talmud doesn't call him by name, okay? Because of what I'm about to read to you, Ben Azai hitzitz vamet. Ben Azai glanced and died. Ben Zoma hitzitz v'nifka. Ben Zoma peered into Pardes and was injured. Probably means that he went crazy. He was mentally injured. Right? So he went crazy. Acher kitzetz banetiyot. Acher cut up the roots. He cut up the roots. That is to say, he became an apostate. Right? He became an apostate. So this is very serious business. Very dangerous stuff we're talking about here. Acher becomes an apostate. Rabbi Akiva yatsa b'shalom. Of the four, only one leaves in peace, and that's Rabbi Akiva. Okay? So Rabbi Akiva goes out in peace. From this, I would learn that at this particular point in time, now we have later times when there's interest in mysticism, always the rabbis of the Talmud are put into, their names become the names of the great mystics in other times. The 13th century, for example, the Zohar, written in the 13th century in Spain, 1285 or so. The author of the Zohar is a pseudonym, really. It's a pseudo-author who is, remember? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, again, was a contemporary at this particular period of time. The chance that he authored the Zohar is about nothing. But, at the end of the 13th century, whoever did author the Zohar took a figure from the rabbinic period in order to say, look, mysticism is always with us, and this was the revelation to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Same thing is done with Rabbi Akiva at a later time. This I consider to be contemporaneous. So this is reflecting, in fact, the period. The reason that I'm underlining that is that there is another Baraita. Again, a Baraita outside of the Mishnah, but contemporaneous to what we're talking about, which is extremely famous And I want to recall it to you, and that's what I've just handed out to you. And this is the Braita de Rabbi Yishmael. Those of you who are familiar with the traditional prayer book will be familiar with the Braita of Rabbi Yishmael, because it is at the end of the Birchot HaShachar, the end of the morning blessings, after the reading of the Korbanot, of the sacrifices and the morning blessings. It says, Rabbi Yishmael Omer B'shlosh Esrei Midot HaTorah Nidreshet. Within 13 different, by 13 different principles is the Torah interpreted. Okay? Mikal v'chomer, from a lenient law to a strict one, and vice versa. Mibinyan av, mibkatuv echad, mibinyan av, mishnei ketuvim. Okay? General principle derived from one text or two related texts. General law followed by specific examples, where the law applies exclusively to those examples, and so on. What you are reading here in the Baraita of Rabbi Yishmael is an excursus on the rational way of interpreting the text, rational interpretation of the text. My teacher, Professor Lieberman, Professor Shaul Lieberman, wrote about this Baraita that there are many parallels between it and Greek logic. And he argues that the Baraita of Rabbi Yishmael, in a way, has its parallels in Aristotle, in the Greek schools, in the type of give and take, in the analysis of text. I would just summarize it by saying, this is a rational approach. It's a rational approach to the interpretation of the Torah text. Any of you who are lawyers use these principles probably daily. You may not have thought of them in these forms, in the way in which they're expounded here, but they're basically the same. Essentially what you're doing is taking logical principles, applying it to a constitution, and trying to derive from it things that you didn't know before. Okay? So this is a logical, rational derivation of ideas. In the name of Rabbi Yishmael, a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, the late, great Professor Avraham Yoshua Heschel wrote a two-volume work called Torah Min HaShamayim Ba'Aspaklaria Shel Adorot, The Torah from Heaven in the Mirror of the Generations. The basis of that book, which is one of his greatest, if not his greatest, but relatively unknown. First of all, he wrote it in Hebrew, and he wrote it in Rabbinic Hebrew. It was translated not so long ago, must have been about a dozen years ago. It was translated by our colleague, Rabbi Gordon Tucker, who is the rabbi in White Plains. He translated it into English. So if any of you want to, he translated and edited Torah Min HaShamayim. It's called, if I'm correct, it's called The Torah from Heaven. Heavenly Torah, that's what it is, I wrote it down. It's called Heavenly Torah. What Heschel says is that in rabbinic literature, there are really two approaches to the Torah. One is the approach of Rabbi Yishmael. The other is the approach of Rabbi Akiva. These are two different approaches. One is a rational approach to the law. The other is a mystical approach to the law. Okay? What you are seeing in the material that we have studied in these three lectures is, in effect, the results of the mystical approach to the law, not the rational approach to the law. But what you have in the Talmud is that they're both there. They are both there. And at different points in time, one or another becomes more popular. People favor a rational approach. People favor a mystical approach. From my perspective, the key thing is that they are both there. That they are both there. I would go even beyond that to say that what we are seeing and what we are reading, what we have read these 3 weeks, we're not finished yet, is really an example of the way in which Torah study is rooted in a certain type of mysticism, which I would like to call normal mysticism. It's not my term. It's the term of the late Max Kedushin. He wrote a book called The Rabbinic Mind. He's a professor at the seminary. We were his students. He calls it normal mysticism. There are two kinds of mysticism, says Kedushin. The heavy and the light. Normal mysticism is mysticism light. Right? What is it? Kedushin used to get up in class and say this. Say, boys, you want your Torah not cold. You want your Torah warm. Normal mysticism is warm. It's warm Torah. It's feeling. It's emotion. It's all those things that cold Torah doesn't give you. Cold Torah is rational, and cold Torah forces you to do this, and cold Torah says you must do it. Torah, cold Torah is not warm Torah. So he then developed a theory based on psychology, the psychology of the 40s and the 50s, where he showed that there was, in rabbinic language, the language itself used by the rabbis was crucial to the nature of what they're communicating. Again, in his language, it's warm language. What we were reading before is warm language. It's emotional language. You have to catch yourself every once in a while. It has this power over you because of its literary nature and its inherent warmth. It is not at all rational stuff. Some of you who are of a more rational bent, when you read this, you say, well, what is it trying to say? Explain it to me. I don't want to explain it to you. Because the very nature of the thing is that it is essentially a piece of literature that can't be explained too much. It can't be explained to you. You have to just read it and feel its warmth, its message on that level. That's where its ability to communicate is. According to Heschel, then, there really are two perspectives on the Torah. My sense of what we are studying is that it is akin to what Kedushin called normal mysticism. In any normal reading of the Torah, you can't help but confront the crowns on the Torah. If you read the Torah, you're a Torah reader, Alan, you read the crowns. The crowns are there. Immediately, if you know that they're there or you don't know that they're there, you know it's odd. There's something odd about this experience. And that's exactly how it's supposed to be. This is not supposed to be a rational discussion. This discussion is supposed to make you think, what's going on here? It's not only the content. It's not only the content. It's even the letters that are supposed to make you think about that. Okay? And then you have an Agadah, like the one that we read, which is to say that all of that is part of the visual side of the communication of the revelation. Okay? And what you're looking at is exactly what Moses saw, and he couldn't understand how it could be that way. It's all behind the story. Okay? Your question is still here.
I can just make a comment. Certainly appreciate everything you said, but the story of Moses and Rabbi Akiva also gives enormous legitimacy to rabbinic interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Because one could have asked, what is the authority of rabbinic interpretation? Mm-hmm. Has Judaism moved to rabbinic Judaism from the more traditional priestly? Here, you get authentication of the process by God and by Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two powerful stamps of approval.
Correct.
Of Rabbi Akiva and implicitly then the entire rabbinic structure.
Exactly. And when you read this in a way one of the things you take away from it is that I guess this is all true. Because they said it's true. And they took the authority, and they in a way, hijacked the authority of Moses.
But for their own purpose. Moses doesn't understand it.
Even if he doesn't understand it. And that's just the most remarkable way of really saying it. That Moses can't understand what Rabbi Akiva is saying.
So, if we do have both sides in the Torah, and we have a rational in what we do and in the rabbinic, and we also have this warm, kind of more emotional, do you need to decide which approach you have, or are you at will to decide, oh, I'm going to make an emotional interpretation here, and I'm going to use a rational here? Are they kind of tools, or are they two world views that you really need to commit to one or the other in your approach?
Or to both. There's no way to really answer that question. This is part of the inner dynamics of Torah study and of Jewish life, frankly. You go through periods of time, in the 19th century, for example, if you read Gretz, we have Gretz over there on the back wall, all the volumes of Gretz's History of the Jews. Magnificent study of the history of the Jews. Gretz looks at the mystical tradition and he says, this was the result of persecution. In other words, all these people were crazy. But we can forgive them. After all, the goyim was so terrible that they made people think these crazy ideas. That's Gretz. So that's the end of the 19th century, he's writing that. It's not until the 1950s that Gershom Scholem publishes his major trends in Jewish mysticism and says Gretz did not have any idea what he was talking about. He was completely wrong. In Jewish life, in the 19th and the 20th centuries, you have a pendulum that swings back and forth between all of these things. This stage of the game, I think there was more willingness to not go to one extreme or another. But I don't know how long that's going to last. It may last 30 minutes. Andy Warhol kind of time. Just a short moment in time. I have no idea how long that's going to last. But it's an imponderable... It's a question we need to ponder. But I don't think it's possible to know the answer.
Right? I think there's an analogy in bioethics. And this split between viewing bioethical decisions from a utilitarian standpoint, mm-hmm. a very rational calculation of risk-benefit, of the greatest good for the greatest number, and then completely separate from that is what I think the bioethicists would call the deontologic approach.
Deontologic, correct.
So leaving aside all of that calculation, is this a right thing to do? Mm-hmm. Is there something wrong with this, no matter how well it fits a utilitarian structure?
Correct.
And humans go back and forth. They have a lot of difficulty integrating these in terms of how they see it. It's almost like the picture you look at, you know, either you see it as a woman or you see it as a wine glass.
I will remind you what we said last week with the negative space and the positive space. It depends on how you look at it.
So, and it's difficult for people to hold on to both of these simultaneously because the structure, and Kahneman, the great Nobel laureate economist, writes about thinking fast and thinking slow. I don't know how many people have read the book. But it's exactly the same sort of analogy of most of the time we use what they call heuristics. We go by our gut feeling and just move along in the world. And then our gut feeling often doesn't really comport with all of the data. And that's when we start to actually dig in and think through in a very, very systematic way a problem. So I think there are a lot of analogies where we live in dichotomous approaches to dealing with different problems. And clearly this is rooted in the evolutionary pressures on our brain. You can make a lot of interesting hypotheses as to why some of this might work best in some situations and others in others that turned out to be an advantage for us and, you know, selective pressure. But I think it's clear that there are analogies to rational structure.
Undoubtedly, you may be, when I left, I was just thinking about the current political campaign. You know, talking about going in strange directions, you know. But, you know, that's what happens. This is really the way people are. Very interesting. But I go back to just so that I not lower the level of the conversation by talking about the political campaign. Let's keep it at Barry's high level here. Remember, we're talking about revelation. I think that that's a key feature of this, that there are two senses here. One is Rabbi Ishmael's understanding that there is a surface or a plain meaning of the text which is comprehensible and which good analysis and good legal analysis should try to achieve, which makes perfectly good sense. And Rabbi Akiva's visual sense, it's much more visual. It's not so much rational as it is visual, that there is an esoteric meaning to the text, and that's partially understood through a visual experience.
What I also get from this is that revelation is a concept. It didn't just happen for the generation with Moses, but it happened with Rabbi Akiva and went back to Moses. So we are constantly experiencing revelation.
Well, it's a very interesting comment, because realize that a lot of what goes on in Jewish life today is a manifestation of that in two opposites. The super Haredi says that, and the super liberal who rejects it says the same thing.
Yes.
It says it's the same argument. Interestingly enough, it's constant revelation. So the super Haredi says, my rabbi told me what Moses heard on Mount Sinai, and therefore my rabbi is right, and we have to do what this rabbi. Wexler listens to that rabbi and says, what's he talking about? He says, no, it's continuous revelation, it's always coming, and we just have to go to the right source. The super liberal says the same thing, it's continuous revelation. We have to go to the most modern, reasonable, thoughtful people who may reject the Torah, you know, because that's the nature of reason. And therefore that's correct. It's absolutely correct. Same thing that the Haredi guy says. Okay? But they have two completely different answers, but it's based on the same approach. It's fascinating. Alan, you're gonna...
No, it's interesting what you say about things happening at the same time. I mean, it goes back to, I think, of Einstein and showing that time is just really a fourth dimension of something of our physical world. You know, I was reading something that said if we had somebody on a distant planet that had a sufficiently large telescope and they were observing Earth today from 65 million light years away, they'd be looking at dinosaurs. So if you're looking for far enough, you can even see the creation of the world. I mean,
correct.
The point is what's now and what was then is really all the same thing.
Correct. Let's go back to the Talmud text for a little bit more. We'll simply reinforce some of the things that we've said. We're at 29b2, on the right side of the page. Amar Rava, halfway down the page. Shiv'a otyot tzrichot shlosha ziyunin. Seven letters require three tagin each. Shlosha ziyunim. Now, it's not exactly clear. It's a three-pronged something or other. Three prongs. Eluhein, shat nisgats. That's what I said to you before. They're shin, ayin, tet, nun, zayin, gimel, tzadi.
And that's only a mnemonic. It doesn't mean anything together.
Correct. It's only a mnemonic. Correct. It's just easy to remember it that way. Okay? Now, go over to the right side of the Talmud text. You have to go into the Hebrew text here. Go into the right side of the Hebrew text. And we'll look at the Tosafot. Remember, the Tosafot are the generation, two generations after Rashi. Rashi's 1040 to 1105. So you're dealing here at the beginning of the 12th century. And I'm looking at the right side of the Talmud text. It's where you have all those pictures. I'm going to the top of all of that, which says Shatnez Gatz. Shatnez Gatz. See that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Shatnez Gatz. Yesh mefarshim gimel ziyunim. There are those who interpret the Talmud's phrase three ziyunim, because we don't know what a ziyun is. It's hard to understand what that means. Hashnayim litzad smol, two on the left side, echad milamala v'echad milamata, one above and one down, v'echad litzad yamin, and one on the right side. So that's in the picture that's we come to first. So the three marks would be like that. Shatnez Gatz. Ubeferush, what does that say? Shebiktav ktivat, and the another perush is Ayidei Rabenu. This is Rashi's understanding. Shetzier echad miyamin mismol, the echad milamala kazeh. One on the right, and one on the left, and one straight up. Right? Rashi's interpretation was like that. One on the left, one on the right, and one in the middle. Od perush sheyesh osin shloshtan lamala. Another perush is that the three of them should go up. Kazeh. Like this. Kitid b'shimush rabba demashma Tet letotafot tzarich gimel. Well, that goes on. But those are three interpretations now of what ziyunin means. You can see how it finally becomes customary, and that is that you have three that go like that. But they're not in the middle of the letter. They're, well, let's see. Let's take a look at our example here. Yeah, there it is. Okay, it's to the right side, to the left side, and in the middle. But it's not here. We have a letter, for example, that has different prongs to it. As in the ayin has two prongs. The shin has three prongs. It's always on the left prong. Okay, and that's discussed later on by the Tosafot. That's their understanding, that it's always like that. Or if you have, let's see, let's take another one. Where do we have Eloheinu, and the Nun of Eloheinu. Okay, there you see, it's this third alternative that the Tosafot brought: one to the right, one to the left, and one straight up. Okay, that's the nature of the crown, and that is in fact the custom. That's I think it's universal, really, in all Sefer Torah that you'll see.
An ancient text that they've discovered, ancient text.
Correct.
Were they written the same as they are today?
The problem is we don't have ancient Torah texts. Most ancient Torah texts, we simply don't have any. We have the Aleppo Codex.
What about the?
Do we have ancient Tfillin?
I don't believe we have the outside of the Tfillin, but we don't have the text.
I know, I saw the case.
Then
what
about
the Dead Sea Scrolls?
That's not Torah scrolls. Not Torah scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls are post-Torah.
But there were variations,
Definitely. Definitely variations.
Are they because of the crowns, or are they because of the personal handwriting?
Personal handwriting, or just traditions. There are also traditions, as in any artwork. You have what your teacher tells you is just a certain way of moving the pen. You'll see that in the student.
There seems to be some kind of partnership in what we read between God and man, because on the first paragraph where he says, Master of the Universe, who is holding you back? And I'm just, it seems odd, and God said to him, there is one man who is destined to exist at the end. So it's almost like a man can hold God back. He's
not a good translation. The translation is not good.
Okay.
Mimiakha means who would disqualify your work? Would disqualify your work. In other words, whoever you're doing it becomes what makes a kosher Torah.
I see.
Okay? So God said, so he says, so why are you adding these things? He says, there's a reason why I'm adding them, because eventually, down the road, somebody's going to interpret. It's called Rabbi Akiva.
And they're going to need these crowns in order.
You don't think that they're saying anything.
Right.
You don't understand.
Right.
There are deeper meanings here, which Rabbi Akiva will understand.
I get it.
Okay? He will understand. Okay?
So, Marla, is there any conjecture as to why these particular letters here? It just says these are the letters.
Right. This is just Halacha Moshe Misinai. It's Halacha Moshe Misinai. Several times in the writing of text, it is simply, this is the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, that the only justification of it. In Maimonides, Maimonides goes through a number of ways that we know what the law is. One of the categories of law is his work on jurisprudence. He does this in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah. One of the categories of law, he says, is called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. He says it's just categorical. It's a categorical statement of the law, and there is simply a tradition in the community that this particular activity has its justification on the basis of Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Otherwise, there is no justification for it whatsoever. We cannot come up with it rationally. Not rational.
As I recall, 3 weeks ago, there was similar analysis of lettering and positioning certain letters had to be done a certain way on the mezuzot.
Correct.
That relate to this in any way?
Well, it's the same. These rules apply to the mezuzah just as they apply to the Sefer Torah. The mezuzah had a few extra issues in terms of the front and the back of it. That there were certain extra things added to the back that had to be positioned in a certain fashion. The Torah scroll, much less, although there are a number of position laws in the Torah scroll. If you look at a Torah scroll, for example, you will see what's called skurot and petuchot. When you come to the end of a paragraph, sometimes there'll be a space in the middle of a line, and sometimes a line will end, and then the next paragraph, in fact, will begin. At the beginning of the next line. Those are all Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Okay? Those are just the way you have to do it. The Skurot and Petuchot. Okay?
And these in any way tie in with the, I know for certain portions of this Torah, like Aseret HaDibrot, the letters are stretched, you see. The Lamed, for example, the horizontal of the Lamed sometimes it goes halfway across.
That's different. That's different. That is scribal minhag. And the reason why that is that a scribe will decide when he's writing how many letters he can fit in the particular line. And it is easy to lengthen certain letters in order to make sure you don't end up with the middle of a word, because you can't put a dash in a word. Okay? You're not allowed to do that. So he's got to figure out, and he tries to do it as well as he can. But if you look at the writing, a very good scribe does it very well. And there's a certain artistry to the whole thing. A poor scribe, you can notice sometimes that he will suddenly run into trouble when he gets past the middle of a line. And he'll try to solve those problems in one of two ways. Either squeezing the letters...
Yeah,
and sometimes the words together.
You see that?
Or if he may solve a problem by figuring the way to do it is to stretch out what he's got left and then start on the next line. The way he stretches it out is to make a long lament. Okay, he's got a flat top there. You can do that with a few of the letters, and you'll see that done in any particular class. You can see it here. Yeah, you can see it here. You can see it here.
I don't know if this can be pedantic, but is it required that the scribe do the lettering in succession, or could the scribe go a few letters ahead or a word ahead?
Well, it depends. In the writing of the mezuzah, it has to be all together. In the writing of the Sefer Torah, it would be impossible to do it in succession. A normal scribe, if he works a long day, takes about 8 months to write a Sefer Torah.
Now my question was different. In a single line, he might be able to space the letters by going to the last letter and then sort of moving.
Oh, going backwards?
Backwards.
Oh no, he has to go forwards.
That's right.
He can't go backwards. It has to, because it says in the writing of a it says v'haya. The verb haya, it was, means that things have to be in as in the word to be. There has to be a form to it, and you can't turn it back, you can't move it backwards. And that has manifestations in different ways. You can't say the Shema backwards. You might want to say that. You might have that kind of a mind to say the Shema backwards. Can't do it. It has to go forward. Same thing as with the writing of the Sefer Torah.
I just wanted to make one comment that choosing seven of them. I mean, we don't know why it is. However, looking at the page, it is decorated. It stands out. But if you had more letters, you might find much less legibility.
Uh-huh.
This might become overly ornate. I mean, it's distracting, less legible. You know, by having seven, the way it arrays on the page is not, is not infringing on those white spaces.
It'd be very interesting if you could do a computer study.
Probably.
And see what the randomness of these things is, to see whether in fact it works out the way you're saying.
8, 9, 10, 11.
Correct.
What's the
average space between these crowns and so on. My purpose in these three lectures, just to conclude now, was to bring a dimension to modern religious life, which is a sensitivity to a mystical dimension, which is not necessarily any kind of way-out mysticism, but what I've called tonight normal mysticism, which is a very basic part, I think, of the ability of any of us, really, to go beyond, to have some sense of the divine, particularly when we are relating to the Torah, which partially is understood rationally and legally, and part of it is, frankly, in another dimension. So if I've at least given some credibility to that other dimension in a sort of light and low-key way, then I will have gone as far as I would like to go. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.